Disc 2.
Chapter 4. Far away on the opposite spiral arm of the galaxy, 500,000 light-years from the star Sol, Zaphod Beeblebrox, president of the Imperial Galactic Government, sped across the seas of Damogran, his iron-drive delta boat winking and flashing in the Damogran sun. Damogran the hot, Damogran the remote, Damogran the almost totally unheard of. Damogran, secret home of the Heart of Gold. The boat sped on across the water. It would be some time before it reached its destination, because Damogran is such an inconveniently arranged planet. It consists of nothing but middling to large desert islands separated by very pretty but annoyingly wide stretches of ocean. The boat sped on. Because of this topographical awkwardness, Damogran has always remained a deserted planet. This is why the Imperial Galactic Government chose Damogran for the Heart of Gold project, because it was so deserted, and the Heart of Gold project was so secret. The boat zipped and skipped across the sea that lay between the main islands of the only archipelago of any useful size on the whole planet. Zaphod Beeblebrox was on his way from the tiny spaceport on Easter Island. The name was an entirely meaningless coincidence. In galactic speak, Easter means small, flat, and light brown. To the Heart of Gold Island, which, by another meaningless coincidence, was called France. One of the side effects of work on the Heart of Gold was a whole string of petty, meaningless coincidences. But it was not in any way a coincidence that today, the day of culmination of the project, the great day of unveiling, the day that the Heart of Gold was finally to be introduced to a marvelling galaxy, was also a great day of culmination for Zaphod Beeblebrox. It was for the sake of this day that he had first decided to run for the presidency, a decision which had sent shockwaves of astonishment throughout the Imperial Galaxy. Zaphod Beeblebrox? President? Not THE Zaphod Beeblebrox! I mean, not THE President! Many had seen it as clinching proof that the whole of known creation had finally gone bananas. Zaphod grinned and gave the boat an extra kick of speed. Zaphod Beeblebrox, adventurer, ex-hippie, good-timer, crook, quite possibly, manic self-publicist, terribly bad at personal relationships, often thought to be completely out to lunch. President. The full title is President of the Imperial Galactic Government. The term imperial is kept, though it is now an anachronism. The hereditary emperor is nearly dead, and has been for many centuries. In the last moments of his dying coma, he was locked in a stasis field which keeps him in a state of perpetual unchangingness. All his heirs are now long dead, and this means that, without any drastic political upheaval, power has simply and effectively moved a rung or two down the ladder, and is now seen to be vested in a body which used to act simply as advisers to the emperor, an elected government assembly headed by a president elected by that assembly. In fact, it vests in no such place. The president in particular is very much a figurehead. He wields no real power whatsoever. He is apparently chosen by the government, but the qualities he is required to display are not those of leadership, but of finely judged outrage. For this reason, the president is always a controversial choice, always an infuriating but fascinating character. His job is not to wield power, but to draw attention away from it. On those criteria, Zaphod Beeblebrox is one of the most successful presidents the galaxy has ever had. He has already spent 2 of his 10 presidential years in prison for fraud. Very, very few people realize that the president and the government have virtually no power at all. And of these few people, only 6 know whence ultimate political power is wielded. Most of the others secretly believe that the ultimate decision-making process is handled by a computer. They couldn't be more wrong. No, no one had gone bananas. Not in that way, at least. Only 6 people in the entire galaxy understood the principle on which the galaxy was governed, and they knew that once Zaphod Beeblebrox had announced his intention to run as president, it was more or less a fait accompli. He was ideal presidency fodder. What they completely failed to understand was why Zaphod was doing it. He banked sharply, shooting a wild wall of water at the sun. Today was the day. Today was the day when they would realize what Zaphod had been up to. Today was what Zaphod Beeblebrox's presidency was all about. Today was also his 200th birthday, but that was just another meaningless coincidence. As he skipped his boat across the seas of Damagrin, he smiled quietly to himself about what a wonderful, exciting day it was going to be. He relaxed and spread his two arms lazily along the seat back. He steered with an extra arm he'd recently had fitted just beneath his right one to help improve his ski boxing. "Hey," he cooed to himself, "you're a real cool boy, you." But his nerves sang a song shriller than a dog whistle. The island of France was about 20 miles long, 5 miles across the middle, sandy and crescent-shaped. In fact, it seemed to exist not so much as an island in its own right, as simply a means of defining the sweep and curve of a huge bay. This impression was heightened by the fact that the inner coastline of the crescent consisted almost entirely of steep cliffs. From the top of the cliff, the land sloped slowly down 5 miles to the opposite shore. On top of the cliffs stood a reception committee. It consisted in large part of the engineers and researchers who had built the Heart of Gold, mostly humanoid, but here and there were a few reptiloid atomineers, two or three green sylph-like maxi-megaloticians, an octopodic physicturalist or two, and a Huluvu. A Huluvu is a super-intelligent shade of the colour blue. All except the Huluvu were resplendent in their multicoloured ceremonial lab coats. The Huluvu had been temporarily refracted into a freestanding prison for the occasion. There was a mood of immense excitement thrilling through them all. Together and between them, they'd gone to and beyond the furthest limits of physical laws, restructured the fundamental fabric of matter, strained, twisted, and broken the laws of possibility and impossibility, but still the greatest excitement of all seemed to be to meet a man with an orange sash round his neck. An orange sash was what the President of the Galaxy traditionally wore. It might not even have made much difference to them if they'd known exactly how much power the President of the Galaxy actually wielded. None at all. Only 6 people in the Galaxy knew that the job of the Galactic President was not to wield power, but to attract attention away from it. Zaphod Beeblebrox was amazingly good at his job. The crowd gasped, dazzled by sun and seamanship, as the presidential speedboat zipped round the headland into the bay. It flashed and shone as it came skating over the sea in wide, skidding turns. In fact, it didn't need to touch the water at all, because it was supported on a hazy cushion of ionized atoms, but just for effect, it was fitted with thin fin blades, which could be lowered into the water. They slashed sheets of water hissing into the air, carved deep gashes in the sea, which swayed crazily and sank back foaming in the boat's wake as it careered across the bay. Zaphod loved effect. It was what he was best at. He twisted the wheel sharply. The boat slewed round in a wild, scything skid beneath the cliff face and dropped to rest lightly on the rocking waves. Within seconds, he was out onto the deck and waved and grinned at over 3 billion people. The 3 billion people weren't actually there, but they watched his every gesture through the eyes of a small robot tri-D camera, which hovered obsequiously in the air nearby. The antics of the president always made amazingly popular tri-D. That's what they were for. He grinned again. 3 billion and 6 people didn't know it, but today would be a bigger antic than anyone had bargained for. The robot camera moved in for a close-up on the more popular of his two heads, and he waved again. He was roughly humanoid in appearance, except for the extra head and third arm. His fair tousled hair stuck out in random directions, his blue eyes glinted with something completely unidentifiable, and his chins were almost always unshaven. A 20-foot-high, transparent globe floated next to his boat, rolling and bobbing, glistening in the brilliant sun. Inside it floated a wide, semicircular sofa, upholstered in glorious red leather. The more the globe bobbed and rolled, the more the sofa stayed perfectly still, steady as an upholstered rock. Again, all done for effect, as much as anything. Zaphod stepped through the wall of the globe and relaxed on the sofa. He spread his two arms along the back and with the third brushed some dust off his knee. His head looked about, smiling. He put his feet up. At any moment, he thought, he might scream. Water boiled up beneath the bubble. It seethed and spouted. The bubble surged into the air, bobbing and rolling on the waterspout. Up, up it climbed, throwing stilts of light at the cliff. Up it surged on the jet, the water falling from beneath it, crashing back into the sea hundreds of feet below. Zaphod smiled, picturing himself. A thoroughly ridiculous form of transport, but a thoroughly beautiful one. At the top of the cliff, the globe wavered for a moment, tipped onto a railed ramp, rolled down it to a small concave platform, and riddled to a halt. To tremendous applause, Zaphod Beeblebrox stepped out of the bubble, his orange sash blazing in the light. The President of the Galaxy had arrived. He waited for the applause to die down, then raised his hand in greeting. "Hi," he said. A government spider sidled up to him and attempted to press a copy of his prepared speech into his hands. Pages 3 to 7 of the original version were at that moment floating soggily on the Damagran Sea some 5 miles out from the bay. Pages 1 and 2 had been salvaged by a Damagran frond-crested eagle and had already become incorporated into an extraordinary new form of nest which the eagle had invented. It was constructed largely of papier-mâché, and it was virtually impossible for a newly hatched baby eagle to break out of it. The Damagran frond-crested eagle had heard of the notion of the survival of the species, but wanted no truck with it. Zaphod Beeblebrox would not be needing his set speech, and he gently deflected the one being offered him by the spider. "Hi," he said again. Everyone beamed at him, or at least nearly everyone. He singled out Trillian from the crowd. Trillian was a girl that Zaphod had picked up recently while visiting a planet, just for fun, incognito. She was slim, darkish, humanoid, with long waves of black hair, a full mouth, an odd little knob of a nose, and ridiculously brown eyes. With her red headscarf knotted in that particular way, and her long, flowing, silky brown dress, she looked vaguely Arabic. Not that anyone there had ever heard of an Arab, of course. The Arabs had very recently ceased to exist. And even when they had existed, they were 500,000 light-years from Damagran. Trillian wasn't anybody in particular, or so Zaphod claimed. She just went around with him rather a lot and told him what she thought of him. "Hi, honey," he said to her. She flashed him a quick, tight smile and looked away. Then she looked back for a moment and smiled more warmly, but by this time he was looking at something else. "Hi," he said to a small knot of creatures from the press, who were standing nearby, wishing that he would stop saying hi and get on with the quotes. He grinned at them particularly, because he knew that in a few moments he would be giving them one hell of a quote. The next thing he said, though, was not a lot of use to them. One of the officials of the party had irritably decided that the president was clearly not in a mood to read the deliciously turned speech that had been written for him, and had flipped the switch on the remote control device in his pocket. Away in front of them, a huge white dome that bulged against the sky cracked down the middle, split, and slowly folded itself down into the ground. Everyone gasped, although they had known perfectly well it was going to do that, because they had built it that way. Beneath it lay uncovered a huge starship, 150 meters long, shaped like a sleek running shoe, perfectly white and mind-bogglingly beautiful. At the heart of it, unseen, lay a small gold box, which carried within it the most brain-wrenching device ever conceived, a device which made this starship unique in the history of the galaxy, a device after which the ship had been named the Heart of Gold. "Wow," said Zaphod Beeblebrox to the Heart of Gold. There wasn't much else he could say. He said it again because he knew it would annoy the press. "Wow." The crowd turned their faces back towards him expectantly. He winked at Trillian, who raised her eyebrows and widened her eyes at him. She knew what he was about to say and thought him a terrible show-off. "That is really amazing," he said. "That really is truly amazing. That is so amazingly amazing, I think I'd like to steal it." A marvellous presidential quote, absolutely true to form. The crowd laughed appreciatively, the newsmen gleefully punched buttons on their sub-ether newsmatics, and the president grinned. As he grinned, his heart screamed unbearably, and he fingered the small, paralyzomatic bomb that nestled quietly in his pocket. Finally, he could bear it no more. He lifted his heads up to the sky, let out a wild whoop in major thirds, threw the bomb to the ground, and ran forward through the sea of suddenly frozen, beaming smiles. Chapter 5. Prosthetnik Vogon Jeltz was not a pleasant sight, even for other Vogons. His highly domed nose rose high above a small, piggy forehead. His dark green, rubbery skin was thick enough for him to play the game of Vogon civil service politics and play it well, and waterproof enough for him to survive indefinitely at sea depths of up to 1,000 feet with no ill effects. Not that he ever went swimming, of course. His busy schedule would not allow it. He was the way he was because billions of years ago, when the Vogons had first crawled out of the sluggish, primeval seas of Vogsphere and lain panting and heaving on the planet's virgin shores, when the first rays of the bright young Vogsol sun had shone across them that morning, it was as if the forces of evolution had simply given up on them there and then, had turned aside in disgust and written them off as an ugly and unfortunate mistake. They never evolved again. They should never have survived. The fact that they did is some kind of tribute to the thick-willed, slug-brained stubbornness of these creatures. Evolution, they said to themselves, who needs it? And what nature refused to do for them, they simply did without, until such time as they were able to rectify the grosser anatomical inconveniences with surgery. Meanwhile, the natural forces on the planet Vogsphere had been working overtime to make up for their earlier blunder. They brought forth scintillating jewel-scuttling crabs, which the Vogons ate, smashing their shells with iron mallets. Tall, aspiring trees of breathtaking slenderness and colour, which the Vogons cut down and burnt the crab meat with. Elegant, gazelle-like creatures with silken coats and dewy eyes, which the Vogons would catch and sit on. They were no use as transport, because their backs would snap instantly, but the Vogons sat on them anyway. Thus the planet Vogsphere whiled away the unhappy millennia until the Vogons suddenly discovered the principles of interstellar travel. Within a few short Vog years, every last Vogon had migrated to the Megabrantis cluster, the political hub of the galaxy, and they now formed the immensely powerful backbone of the Galactic Civil Service. They have attempted to acquire learning, they have attempted to acquire style and social grace, but in most respects the modern Vogon is little different from his primitive forebears. Every year they import 27,000 scintillating jewel scuttling crabs from their native planet, and while away a happy drunken night smashing them to bits with iron mallets. Prosthetnik Vogon Jeltz was a fairly typical Vogon in that he was thoroughly vile. Also, he did not like hitchhikers. Somewhere in a small, dark cabin, buried deep in the intestines of Prosthetnik Vogon Jeltz's flagship, a small match flared nervously. The owner of the match was not a Vogon, but he knew all about them, and he was right to be nervous. His name was Ford Prefect. Ford Prefect's original name is only pronounceable in an obscure Betelgeusean dialect, now virtually extinct since the great collapsing Hurung disaster of galactic sidereal year 03758, which wiped out all the old Praxibetel communities on Betelgeuse 7. Ford's father was the only man on the entire planet to survive the great collapsing Hurung disaster, by an extraordinary coincidence that he was never able satisfactorily to explain. The whole episode is shrouded in deep mystery. In fact, no one ever knew what a Hurung was, nor why it had chosen to collapse on Betelgeuse 7, particularly. Ford's father, magnanimously waving aside the clouds of suspicion that had inevitably settled around him, came to live on Betelgeuse 5, where he both fathered and uncled Ford. In memory of his now dead race, he christened him in the ancient Praxibetel tongue. Because Ford never learnt to say his original name, his father eventually died of shame, which is still a terminal disease in some parts of the galaxy. The other kids at school nicknamed him Ix, which in the language of Betelgeuse 5 translates as boy who is not able satisfactorily to explain what a hurung is, nor why it should choose to collapse on Betelgeuse 7. Ford looked about the cabin, but could see very little. Strange, monstrous shadows loomed and leaped with the tiny flickering flame, but all was quiet. He breathed a silent thank you to the Dentrasses. The Dentrasses are an unruly tribe of Gourmands, a wild but pleasant bunch, whom the Vogons had recently taken to employing as catering staff on their long-haul fleets, on the strict understanding that they keep themselves very much to themselves. This suited the Dentrasses fine, because they loved Vogon money, which is one of the hardest currencies in space, but loathed the Vogons themselves. The only sort of Vogon a Dentrassi liked to see was an annoyed Vogon. It was because of this tiny piece of information that Ford Prefect was not now a whiff of hydrogen, ozone, and carbon monoxide. He heard a slight groan. By the light of the match, he saw a heavy shape moving slightly on the floor. Quickly, he took the match out, reached in his pocket, found what he was looking for, and took it out. He ripped it open and shook it. He crouched on the floor. The shape moved again. Ford Prefect said, "I bought some peanuts." Arthur Dent moved and groaned again, muttering incoherently. "Here, have some," urged Ford, shaking the packet again. "If you've never been through a matter transference beam before, you've probably lost some salt and protein. The beer you had should have cushioned your system a bit." Said Arthur Dent. He opened his eyes. "It's dark," he said. "Yes," said Ford Prefect. "It's dark." "No light," said Arthur Dent. "Dark, no light." One of the things Ford Prefect had always found hardest to understand about humans was their habit of continually stating and repeating the very, very obvious, as in, "It's a nice day," or "You're very tall," or "Oh dear, you seem to have fallen down a 30-foot well. Are you all right?" At first, Ford had formed a theory to account for this strange behaviour. If human beings don't keep exercising their lips, he thought, their mouths probably seize up. After a few months' consideration and observation, he abandoned this theory in favour of a new one. If they don't keep on exercising their lips, he thought, their brains start working. After a while, he abandoned this one as well as being obstructively cynical, and decided he quite liked human beings after all, but he always remained desperately worried about the terrible number of things they didn't know about. "Yes," he agreed with Arthur, "no light." He helped Arthur to some peanuts. "How do you feel?" he asked him. "Like a military academy," said Arthur. "Bits of me keep on passing out." Ford stared at him blankly in the darkness. "If I asked you where the hell we were," said Arthur weakly, "would I regret it?" Ford stood up. "We're safe," he said. "Oh, good," said Arthur. "We're in a small galley cabin," said Ford, "in one of the spaceships of the Vogon Constructor Fleet." "Ah," said Arthur. "This is obviously some strange usage of the word safe that I wasn't previously aware of." Ford struck another match to help him search for a light switch. Monstrous shadows leaped and loomed again. Arthur struggled to his feet and hugged himself apprehensively. Hideous alien shapes seemed to throng about him. The air was thick with musty smells which sidled into his lungs without identifying themselves, and a low, irritating hum kept his brain from focusing. "How did we get here?" he asked, shivering slightly. "We hitched a lift," said Ford. "Excuse me," said Arthur. "Are you trying to tell me that we just stuck out our thumbs and some green bug-eyed monster stuck his head out and said, 'Hi, fellas, hop right in, I can take you as far as the Basingstoke roundabout?'" "Well," said Ford, "the thumb's an electronic sub-ether signalling device. The roundabout's at Barnard's Star, 6 light-years away, but otherwise that's more or less right." "And the bug-eyed monster?" "Is green, yes." "Fine," said Arthur. "When can I go home?" "You can't," said Ford Prefect, and found the light switch. "Shade your eyes," he said, and turned it on. Even Ford was surprised. "Good grief," said Arthur. Is this really the interior of a flying saucer? Prosthetnik Vogon Jeltz heaved his unpleasant green body round the control bridge. He always felt vaguely irritable after demolishing populated planets. He wished that someone would come and tell him it was all wrong so he could shout at them and feel better. He flopped as heavily as he could onto his control seat in the hope that it would break and give him something to be genuinely angry about. But it only gave a complaining sort of creak. "Go away!" he shouted at a young Vogon guard who entered the bridge at that moment. The guard vanished immediately, feeling rather relieved. He was glad it wouldn't now be him who delivered the report they'd just received. The report was an official release, which said that a wonderful new form of spaceship drive was at this moment being unveiled at a government research base on Damogren, which would henceforth make all hyperspatial express routes unnecessary. Another door slid open, but this time the Vogon captain didn't shout, because it was the door from the galley quarters, where the Dantrasis prepared his meals. A meal would be most welcome. A huge furry creature bounded through the door with his lunch tray. It was grinning like a maniac. Prosthetnik Vogon Jeltz was delighted. He knew that when a Dantrasi looked that pleased with itself, there was something going on somewhere on the ship that he could get very angry about indeed. Ford and Arthur stared around them.
"Well, what do you think?" said Ford. "It's a bit squalid, isn't it?"
Ford frowned at the grubby mattresses, unwashed cups, and unidentifiable bits of smelly alien underwear that lay around the cramped cabin.
"Well, this is a working ship, you see," said Ford. "These are Dantrasi's sleeping quarters."
"I thought you said they were called Vogons or something," said Arthur.
"Yes," said Ford. "The Vogons are on the ship, the Dantrasis are the cooks. They let us on board."
I'm confused," said Arthur.
"Here, have a look at this," said Ford.
He sat down on one of the mattresses and rummaged about in his satchel. Arthur prodded the mattress nervously and then sat on it himself. In fact, he had very little to be nervous about, because all mattresses grown in the swamps of Squanchula Zeta are very thoroughly killed and dried before being put to service. Very few have ever come to life again. Ford handed the book to Arthur.
"What is it?" asked Arthur.
"The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's a sort of electronic book. It tells you everything you need to know about anything. That's its job."
Arthur turned it over nervously in his hands.
"I like the cover," he said. "Don't panic. It's the first helpful or intelligible thing anybody's said to me all day."
"I'll show you how it works," said Ford.
He snatched it from Arthur, who was still holding it as if it was a 2-week dead lark, and pulled it out of its cover. "You press this button here, you see, and the screen lights up, giving you the index." A screen, about 3 inches by 4, lit up, and characters began to flicker across the surface.
"You want to know about Vogon, so I entered that name, so."
His fingers tapped some more keys, and there we are. The words "Vogon Constructor Fleets" flared in green across the screen. Ford pressed a large red button at the bottom of the screen, and words began to undulate across it. At the same time, the book began to speak the entry as well, in a still, quiet, measured voice. This is what the book said. "Vogon Constructor Fleets. Here is what to do if you want to get a lift from a Vogon. Forget it. They are one of the most unpleasant races in the galaxy, not actually evil, but bad-tempered, bureaucratic, officious, and callous. They wouldn't even lift a finger to save their own grandmothers from the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Tral, without orders signed in triplicate, sent in, sent back, queried, lost, found, subjected to public inquiry, lost again, and finally buried in soft peat for 3 months and recycled as firelighters. The best way to get a drink out of a Vogon is to stick your finger down his throat. And the best way to irritate him is to feed his grandmother to the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Tral. On no account allow a Vogon to read poetry at you."
Arthur blinked at it. "What a strange book. How did we get a lift, then?"
"That's the point. It's out of date now," said Ford, sliding the book back into its cover. "I'm doing the field research for the new revised edition, and one of the things I'll have to include is a bit about how the Vogons now employ Dantrasi cooks, which gives us rather a useful little loophole."
A pained expression crossed Arthur's face. "But who are the Dantrasi?"
he said. Oh, great guys, said Ford. They're the best cooks and the best drinks mixers, and they don't give a wet slap about anything else. And they'll always help hitchhikers aboard, partly because they like the company, but mostly because it annoys the Vogons, which is exactly the sort of thing you need to know if you're an impoverished hitchhiker trying to see the marvels of the universe for less than 30 Altarian dollars a day. And that's my job. Fun, isn't it? Arthur looked lost. It's amazing, he said, and frowned at one of the other mattresses. Unfortunately, I got stuck on the Earth rather longer than I intended, said Ford. I came for a week and got stuck for 15 years.
But how did you get there in the first place, then?
Oh, easy. I got a lift with a teaser.
A teaser?
Yeah.
What is a
teaser? Teasers are usually rich kids with nothing to do. They cruise around looking for planets which haven't made interstellar contact yet and buzz them.
Buzz them?
Arthur began to feel that Ford was enjoying making life difficult for him. Yeah, said Ford. They buzz them. They find some isolated spot with very few people around. Then they land right by some poor unsuspecting soul whom no one's ever going to believe, and then strut up and down in front of him wearing silly antennae on their head and making beep-beep noises. Rather childish, really.
Ford leant back on the mattress with his hands behind his head and looked infuriatingly pleased with himself.
Ford, insisted Arthur, I don't know if this sounds like a silly question, but what am I doing here?
Well, you know that, said Ford. I rescued you from the Earth.
And, what's happened to the Earth?
Ah, it's been demolished.
Has it? Said Arthur levelly.
Yes, it just boiled away into space.
Look, said Arthur, I'm a bit upset about that.
Ford frowned himself and seemed to roll the thought around in his mind.
Yes, I can understand that, he said at last.
Understand that, shouted Arthur. Understand that. Ford sprang up. Keep looking at the book, he hissed urgently.
What?
Don't panic.
I'm not panicking.
Yes, you are.
All right, so I am panicking. What else is there to do?
You just come along with me and have a good time. The galaxy is a fun place. You need to have this fish in your ear.
I beg your pardon,
said Arthur, rather politely, he thought. Ford was holding up a small glass jar, which quite clearly had a small yellow fish wriggling around in it. Arthur blinked at him. He wished there was something simple and recognisable he could grasp hold of. He would have felt safe if alongside the Dentrassi underwear, the piles of squanchulous mattresses, and the man from Beetlejuice holding up a small yellow fish and offering to put it in his ear, if he'd been able to see just a small packet of cornflakes. But he couldn't. And he didn't feel safe. Suddenly, a violent noise leapt at them from no source that he could identify. He gasped in terror at what sounded like a man trying to gargle whilst fighting off a pack of wolves.
Shh, said Ford. Listen, it might be important.
Important?
It's the Vogon captain making an announcement on the Tannoy.
You mean that's how Vogons talk?
Listen! But I can't speak, Vogon. You don't need to. Just put this fish in your ear.
Ford, with a lightning movement, clapped his hand to Arthur's ear, and he had the sudden sickening sensation of the fish slithering deep into his oral tract. Gasping with horror, he scrabbled at his ear for a second or so, but then slowly turned goggle-eyed with wonder. He was experiencing the oral equivalent of looking at a picture of two black silhouetted faces and suddenly seeing it as a picture of a white candlestick. Or of looking at a lot of coloured dots on a piece of paper, which suddenly resolve themselves into the figure 6, and mean that your optician is going to charge you a lot of money for a new pair of glasses. He was still listening to the howling gargles, he knew that, only now it had somehow taken on the semblance of perfectly straightforward English. This is what he heard. Chapter 6.
Have a good time. Message repeats. This is your captain speaking, so stop whatever you're doing and pay attention. First of all, I see from our instruments that we have a couple of hitchhikers aboard. Hello, wherever you are. Just want to make it totally clear that you are not at all welcome. I worked hard to get where I am today, and I didn't become captain of a Vogon constructor ship simply so I could turn it into a taxi service for a load of degenerate freeloaders. I've sent out a search party, and as soon as they find you, I will put you off the ship. If you're very lucky, I might read you some of my poetry first. Secondly, we are about to jump into hyperspace for the journey to Barnard Star. On arrival, we will stay in dock for a 72-hour refit, and no one's to leave the ship during that time. I repeat, all planet leave is cancelled. I've just had an unhappy love affair, so I don't see why anybody else should have a good time. Message ends.
The noise stopped. Arthur discovered to his embarrassment that he was lying curled up in a small ball on the floor with his arms wrapped around his head. He smiled weakly.
Charming man, he said. I wish I had a daughter so I could forbid her to marry one.
You wouldn't need to, said Ford. They've got as much sex appeal as a road accident.
No, don't move, he added as Arthur began to uncurl himself. You'd better be prepared for the jump into hyperspace. It's unpleasantly like being drunk.
Well, what's so unpleasant about being drunk, said Arthur.
You ask a glass of water.
Arthur thought about this.
Ford, he said.
Yep.
What's this fish doing in my ear?
It's translating for you. It's a Babel fish. Look it up in the book if you like. He tossed over the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and then curled himself up into a fetal ball to prepare himself for the jump. At that moment, the bottom fell out of Arthur's mind. His eyes turned inside out. His feet began to leak out of the top of his head. The room folded flat around him, spun around, shifted out of existence, and left him sliding into his own navel. They were passing through hyperspace.
The Babel fish, said the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy quietly, is small, yellow, and leech-like, and probably the oddest thing in the universe. It feeds on brainwave energy received not from its own carrier, but from those around it. It absorbs all unconscious mental frequencies from this brainwave energy to nourish itself with. It then excretes into the mind of its carrier a telepathic matrix formed by combining the conscious thought frequencies with nerve signals picked up from the speech centers of the brain which has supplied them. The practical upshot of all this is that if you stick a Babel fish in your ear, you can instantly understand anything said to you in any form of language. These speech patterns you actually hear decode the brainwave matrix which has been fed into your mind by your Babel fish. Now, it is such a bizarrely improbable coincidence that anything so mind-bogglingly useful could have evolved purely by chance that some thinkers have chosen to see it as a final and clinching proof of the non-existence of God. The argument goes something like this. I refuse to prove that I exist, says God, for proof denies faith, and without faith I am nothing. But, says man, the Babel fish is a dead giveaway, isn't it? It could not have evolved by chance. It proves you exist, and so therefore, by your own arguments, you don't, QED. Oh dear, says God, I hadn't thought of that, and promptly vanishes in a puff of logic. Oh, that was easy, says man, and for an encore goes on to prove that black is white, and gets himself killed on the next zebra crossing. Most leading theologians claim that this argument is a load of dingo's kidneys, but that didn't stop Ulon Kalufid making a small fortune when he used it as a central theme for his best-selling book. Well, that about wraps it up for God. Meanwhile, the poor Babel fish, by effectively removing all barriers to communication between different races and cultures, has caused more and bloodier wars than anything else in the history of creation. Arthur let out a low groan. He was horrified to discover that the kick through hyperspace hadn't killed him. He was now 6 light-years from the place that the Earth would have been if it still existed. The Earth. Visions of it swam sickeningly through his nauseated mind. There was no way his imagination could feel the impact of the whole Earth having gone. It was too big. He prodded his feelings by thinking that his parents and his sister had gone. No reaction. He thought of all the people he had been close to. No reaction. Then he thought of a complete stranger he'd been standing behind in the queue at the supermarket 2 days before, and felt a sudden stab. The supermarket was gone. Everyone in it was gone. Nelson's column had gone. Nelson's column had gone, and there would be no outcry, because there was no one left to make an outcry. From now on, Nelson's column only existed in his mind. England
only existed in his mind. His mind stuck here in this dank, smelly, steel-lined spaceship. A wave of claustrophobia closed in on him. England no longer existed. He'd got that. Somehow he'd got it. He tried again. America, he thought, has gone. He couldn't grasp it. He decided to start smaller again. New York has gone. No reaction. He never seriously believed it existed anyway. The dollar, he thought, has sunk forever. Slight tremor there. Every Bogart movie has been wiped, he said to himself, and that gave him a nasty knock. McDonald's, he thought, there is no longer any such thing as a McDonald's hamburger. He passed out. When he came round a second later, he found that he was sobbing for his mother. He jerked himself violently to his feet. Ford! Ford looked up from where he was sitting in a corner, humming to himself. He always found the actual travelling through space part of space travel rather trying. Yeah, he said. If you're a researcher on this book thing, and you were on Earth, you must have been gathering material on it. Well, I was able to extend the original entry a bit, yes. Let me see what it says in this edition, then. I've got to see it. Yeah, okay. Ford passed it over again. Arthur grabbed hold of it and tried to stop his hands shaking. He pressed the entry for the relevant page. The screen flashed and swirled and resolved into a page of print. Arthur stared at it. It doesn't have an entry, he burst out. Ford looked over his shoulder. Yes, it does, he said. Look, down there, see at the bottom of the screen, just under Eccentric Galumbitz, the triple-breasted whore of Eroticon 6. Arthur followed Ford's finger and saw where it was pointing. For a moment it still didn't register, then his mind nearly blew up. What? Harmless? Is that all it's got to say? Harmless? One word? Ford shrugged. Well, there are 100 billion stars in the galaxy and only a limited amount of space in the book's microprocessors, he said. And no one knew much about the Earth, of course. Well, for God's sake, I hope you managed to rectify that a bit. Oh, yes, well, I managed to transmit a new entry off to the editor. He had to trim it a bit, but it's still an improvement. And what does it say now? Asked Arthur. Mostly harmless, admitted Ford with a slightly embarrassed cough. Mostly harmless, shouted Arthur. What was that noise? Hissed Ford. It was me shouting, shouted Arthur. No, shut up, said Ford. I think we're in trouble. You think we're in trouble? Outside the door were the clear sounds of marching footsteps. The Dentrassi? Whispered Arthur. No, those are steel-tipped boots, said Ford. There was a sharp, ringing rap on the door. Then who is it? Said Arthur. Well, said Ford, if we're lucky, it's just the Vogons come to throw us into space. And if we're unlucky? If we're unlucky, said Ford grimly, the captain might be serious in his threat that is going to read us some of his poetry first. Chapter 7. Vogon poetry is, of course, the third worst in the universe. The second worst is that of the Asgoths of Kria. During a recitation by their poet master, Grunthos the Flatulent, of his poem Ode to a Small Lump of Green Putty I Found in My Armpit One Midsummer Morning, four of his audience died of internal hemorrhaging, and the president of the Mid-Galactic Arts Nobbling Council survived by gnawing one of his own legs off. Grunthos is reported to have been disappointed by the poem's reception and was about to embark on a reading of his 12-book epic entitled My Favourite Bathtime Gurgles when his own major intestine, in a desperate attempt to save life and civilization, leapt straight up through his neck and throttled his brain. The very worst poetry of all perished along with its creator, Paula Nancy Millstone Jennings of Greenbridge, Essex, England, in the destruction of the planet Earth. Prosthetnik Vogon Jeltz smiled very slowly. This was not done so much for effect as because he was trying to remember the sequence of muscle movements. He had had a terribly therapeutic yell at his prisoners and was now feeling quite relaxed and ready for a little callousness. The prisoners sat in poetry appreciation chairs, strapped in. Vogons suffered no illusions as to the regard their works were generally held in.
Their early attempts at composition had been part of a bludgeoning insistence that they be accepted as a properly evolved and cultured race, but now the only thing that kept them going was sheer bloody-mindedness. The sweat stood out cold on Ford Prefect's brow and slid round the electrodes strapped to his temples. These were attached to a battery of electronic equipment, imagery intensifiers, rhythmic modulators, alliterative residulators and simile dumpers, all designed to heighten the experience of the poem and make sure that not a single nuance of the poet's thought was lost. Arthur Dent sat and quivered. He had no idea what he was in for, but he knew that he hadn't liked anything that had happened so far and didn't think things were likely to change. The Vogon began to read a fetid little passage of his own devising. "Oh, freddled grunt bugly," he began. Spasms racked Ford's body. This was worse than even he had been prepared for. "Thy micturations are to me as plurdled gabble blotchets on a lurgid bee." "Ah!" went Ford Prefect, wrenching his head back as lumps of pain thumped through it. He could dimly see beside him Arthur lolling and rolling in his seat. He clenched his teeth. "Group, I implore thee," continued the merciless Vogon, "my funting turling drones." His voice was rising to a horrible pitch of impassioned stridency. "And hoopsiously drangle me with crinkly bindle wordles, or I will rend thee in the gobberworts with my blurgle crunchancy if I don't." cried Ford Prefect, and through one final spasm as the electronic enhancement of the last line caught him full blast across the temples, he went limp. Arthur lolled. "Now, earthlings," whirred the Vogon. He didn't know that Ford Prefect was in fact from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse, and wouldn't have cared if he had. "I present you with a simple choice. Either die in the vacuum of space, or..." He paused for melodramatic effect. "Tell me how good you thought my poem was." He threw himself backwards into a huge, leathery, bat-shaped seat and watched them. He did the smile again. Ford was rasping for breath. He rolled his dusty tongue round his parched mouth and moaned. Arthur said brightly, "Actually, I quite liked it." Ford turned and gaped. Here was an approach that had quite simply not occurred to him. The Vogon raised a surprised eyebrow that effectively obscured his nose and was therefore no bad thing. "Oh, good," he whirred in considerable astonishment. "Oh, yes," said Arthur. I thought that some of the metaphysical imagery was really particularly effective." Ford continued to stare at him, slowly organising his thoughts around this totally new concept. Were they really going to be able to bareface their way out of this?
"Yes, do continue," invited the Vogon.
"Interesting rhythmic devices, too," continued Arthur, "which seem to counterpoint the, he floundered. Ford leapt to his rescue, hazarding, "counterpoint the surrealism of the underlying metaphor of the, he floundered too, but Arthur was ready again. "Humanity of the Vogonity," Ford hissed at him. "Oh, yes, Vogonity, sorry, of the poet's compassionate soul," Arthur felt he was on the home stretch now, "which contrives, through the medium of the verse structure, to sublimate this, transcend that, and come to terms with the fundamental dichotomies of the other," he was reaching a triumphant crescendo, "and one is left with a profound and vivid insight into, suddenly gave out on him. Ford leapt in with the coup de grace. "Into whatever it was the poem was about," he yelled out of the corner of his mouth. "Well done, Arthur, that was very good." The Vogon perused them. For a moment his embittered racial soul had been touched, but he thought, no, too little, too late. His voice took on the quality of a cat snagging brushed nylon.
"So what you're saying is that I write poetry because underneath my mean, callous, heartless exterior, I really just want to be loved," he said. "Is that right?"
Ford laughed a nervous laugh.
"Well, I mean, yes," he said. "Don't we all, deep down, you know?"
The Vogon stood up.
"No, well, you're completely wrong," he said. I just write poetry to throw my mean, callous, heartless exterior into sharp relief. I'm going to throw you off the ship anyway. Guard, take the prisoners to number 3 airlock and throw them out. What? Shouted Ford. A huge young Vogon guard stepped forward and yanked them out of their straps with his huge blubbery arms. You can't throw us into space, yelled Ford. We're trying to write a book. Resistance is useless, shouted the Vogon guard back at him. It was the first phrase he'd learnt when he joined the Vogon Guard Corps. The captain watched with detached amusement and then turned away. Arthur stared round him wildly. I don't want to die now, he yelled. I've still got a headache. I don't want to go to heaven with a headache. I'd be all cross and wouldn't enjoy it. The guard grasped them both firmly round the neck and, bowing deferentially towards his captain's back, hoiked them both protesting out of the bridge. A steel door closed and the captain was on his own again. He hummed quietly and mused to himself, lightly fingering his notebook of verses. He said. Counterpoint the surrealism of the underlying metaphor. He considered this for a moment and then closed the book with a grim smile. Death's too good for them, he said. The long, steel-lined corridor echoed to the feeble struggles of the two humanoids clamped firmly under the rubbery Vogon armpits. This is great, spluttered Arthur. This is really terrific. Let go of me, you brute. The Vogon guard dragged them on. Don't you worry, said Ford. I'll think of something. He didn't sound too hopeful. Resistance is useless, bellowed the guard. Just don't say things like that, stammered Ford. How can anyone maintain a positive mental attitude if you're saying things like that? My God, complained Arthur, you're talking about a positive mental attitude and you haven't even had your planet demolished today. I woke up this morning and thought I'd have a nice relaxed day, do a bit of reading, brush the dog. It's now just after 4 in the afternoon and I'm already being thrown out of an alien spaceship 6 light years from the smoking remains of the Earth. He spluttered and gurgled as the Vogon tightened his grip. All right, said Ford, just stop panicking. Who said anything about panicking? Snapped Arthur. This is still just culture shock. You wait till I've settled down into the situation and found my bearings. Then I'll start panicking. Arthur, you're getting hysterical. Shut up. Ford tried desperately to think, but was interrupted by the guard shouting again. Resistance is useless. And you can shut up as well, snapped Ford. Resistance is useless. Oh, give it a rest, said Ford. He twisted his head till he was looking straight up into his captor's face. A thought struck him. Do you really enjoy this sort of thing? He asked suddenly. The Vogon stopped dead, and a look of immense stupidity swept slowly over his face. Enjoy? He boomed. What do you mean? What I mean, said Ford, is does it give you a full, satisfying life? I mean, stomping around, shouting, pushing people out of spaceships? The Vogon stared up at the low steel ceiling, and his eyebrows almost rolled over each other. His mouth slacked. Finally, he said, Well, the hours are good. They'd have to be, agreed Ford. Arthur twisted his head round to look at Ford. Ford, what are you doing? He asked in an amazed whisper. Oh, just trying to take an interest in the world around me, okay? He said. So, the hours are pretty good then, he resumed. The Vogon stared down at him as sluggish thoughts moiled around in the murky depths. Yeah, he said. But now you come to mention it, most of the actual minutes are pretty lousy. Except, he thought again, which required looking at the ceiling. Except some of the shouting I quite like. He filled his lungs and bellowed. Resistances! Yeah, sure, interrupted Ford hurriedly. You're good at that, I can tell. But if it's mostly lousy, he said slowly, giving the words time to reach their mark, then why do you do it? What is it? The girls, the leather, the machismo, or do you just find that coming to terms with the mindless tedium of it all presents an interesting challenge? Arthur looked backwards and forwards between them in bafflement. Said the guard. I don't know. I think I just sort of do it, really. My aunt said that spaceship guard was a good career for a young Vogon. You know, the uniform, the low-slung stun-ray holster, the mindless tedium. There you are, Arthur, said Ford, with the air of someone reaching the conclusion of his argument. You think you've got problems? Arthur rather thought he had,
Apart from the unpleasant business with his home planet, the Vogon guard had half-throttled him already, and he didn't like the sound of being thrown into space very much.
"Try and understand his problem," insisted Ford. "Here he is, poor lad. His entire life's work is stamping around, throwing people off spaceships, and shouting," added the guard. "And shouting, sure," said Ford, patting the blubbery arm clamped round his neck in friendly condescension. "And he doesn't even know why he's doing it." Arthur agreed this was very sad. He did this with a small, feeble gesture because he was too asphyxiated to speak.
Deep rumblings of bemusement came from the guard.
"Well, now you put it like that, I suppose." "Good lad," encouraged Ford. "But, all right," went on the rumblings. "So what's the alternative?"
"Well," said Ford, brightly but slowly, "stop doing it, of course. Tell them," he went on, "you're not going to do it any more."
He felt he ought to add something to that, but for the moment the guard seemed to have his mind occupied, pondering that much.
Said the guard.
Well, that doesn't sound that great to me.
Ford suddenly felt the moment slipping away.
No, wait a minute, he said. That's just the start, you see. There's more to it than that, you see.
But at that moment, the guard renewed his grip and continued his original purpose of lugging his prisoners to the airlock. He was obviously quite touched.
No, I think if it's all the same to you, he said, I'd better get you both shoved into this airlock and then go and get on with some other bits of shouting I've got to do.
It wasn't all the same to Ford Prefect at all.
Come on now, but look,
he said, less slowly, less brightly. Said Arthur, without any clear inflection.
But hang on, pursued Ford. There's music and art and things to tell you about. Oh!
Resistance is useless, bellowed the guard, and then added,
you see, if I can keep it up, I can eventually get promoted to senior shouting officer, and there aren't usually many vacancies for non-shouting and non-pushing people about officers, so I think I'd better stick to what I know.
They had now reached the airlock. A large circular steel hatchway of massive strength and weight let into the inner skin of the craft. The guard operated the control and the hatchway swung smoothly open.
But thanks for taking an interest, said the Vogon guard. Bye now!
He flung Ford and Arthur through the hatchway into the small chamber within. Arthur lay panting for breath. Ford scrambled round and flung his shoulder uselessly against the reclosing hatchway.
But listen! He shouted to the guard. There's a whole world you don't know anything about yet. Here, how about this?
Desperately, he grabbed for the only bit of culture he knew offhand. He hummed the first bar of Beethoven's Fifth.
Da-da-da-dum! Doesn't that stir anything in you?
No, said the guard. Not really, but I'll mention it to my aunt.
If he said anything further after that, it was lost. The hatchway sealed itself tight, and all sound was lost bar the faint, distant hum of the ship's engines. They were in a brightly polished cylindrical chamber, about 6 feet in diameter and 10 feet long. Ford looked around it, panting.
A potentially bright lad, I thought, he said, and slumped against the curved wall.
Arthur was still lying in the curve of the floor where he had fallen. He didn't look up. He just lay panting.
We're trapped now, aren't we?
Yes, said Ford, we're trapped.
Well, didn't you think of anything? I thought you said you were going to think of something. Perhaps you thought of something I didn't notice.
Oh, yes, I thought of something, panted Ford. Arthur looked up expectantly. But unfortunately, continued Ford, it rather involved being on the other side of this airtight hatchway. He kicked the hatch they'd just been thrown through.
But it was a good idea, was it?
Oh, yes, it was very neat.
What was it?
Well, I hadn't worked out all the details yet. Not much point now, is there?
So, what happens next? Asked Arthur.
Oh, well, the hatchway in front of us will open automatically in a few moments, and we will shoot out into deep space, I expect, and, asphyxiate. I mean, if you breathe hard for a few moments beforehand and then expel all the air from your lungs, you can last out there for, a good 30 seconds, said Ford.
He stuck his hands behind his back, raised his eyebrows, and started to hum an old Beetlejuicean battle hymn. To Arthur's eyes, he suddenly looked very alien.
So,
This is it, said Arthur. We're going to die. Yes, said Ford.
Except, no! Wait a minute!
He suddenly lunged across the chamber at something behind Arthur's line of vision.
What's this switch? He cried. What? Where?
Cried Arthur, twisting around. No, I was only fooling, said Ford. We are going to die after all. He slumped against the wall again and carried on the tune from where he had left off.
You know, said Arthur, it's at times like this when I'm trapped in a Vogon airlock with a man from Betelgeuse and about to die of asphyxiation in deep space that I really wish I'd listened to what my mother told me when I was young.
Why, what did she tell you?
I don't know, I didn't listen.
Oh, Ford carried on humming.
This is terrific, Arthur thought to himself. Nelson's column's gone, McDonald's have gone, and all that's left is me and the words mostly harmless. Any second now, all that will be left is mostly harmless. And yesterday the planet seemed to be doing so well.
A motor whirred. A slight hiss built into a deafening roar of rushing air as the outer hatchway opened onto an empty blackness studded with tiny, impossibly bright points of light. Ford and Arthur popped into outer space like corks from a toy gun. Chapter 8. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a wholly remarkable book. It has been compiled and recompiled many times over many years and under many different editorships. It contains contributions from countless numbers of travellers and researchers. The introduction begins like this. Space, it says, is big. Really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Listen! And so on. After a while, the style settles down a bit, and it begins to tell you things you really need to know, like the fact that the fabulously beautiful planet Bethselamin is now so worried about the cumulative erosion caused by 10 billion visiting tourists a year that any net imbalance between the amount you eat and the amount you excrete whilst on the planet is surgically removed from your body weight when you leave. So, every time you go to the lavatory there, it is vitally important to get a receipt. To be fair, though, when confronted by the sheer enormity of the distances between the stars, better minds than the one responsible for the guide's introduction have faltered. Some invite you to consider for a moment a peanut in Reading and a small walnut in Idaho, and other such dizzying concepts. The simple truth is that interstellar distances will not fit into the human imagination. Even light, which travels so fast that it takes most races thousands of years to realize that it travels at all, takes time to journey between the stars. It takes 8 minutes to journey from the star Sol to the place where the Earth used to be, and 4 years more to arrive at Sol's nearest stellar neighbor, Alpha Proxima. For light to reach the other side of the galaxy, for it to reach Damogren, for instance, takes rather longer. 500,000 years. The record for hitchhiking this distance is just under 5 years, but you don't get to see much on the way. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy says that if you hyperventilate and then empty your lungs, you can survive in the total vacuum of space for about 30 seconds. However, it does go on to say that, what with space being the mind-boggling size it is, the chances of getting picked up by another ship within those 30 seconds are 2 to the power of 276,709 to 1 against. By a totally staggering coincidence, that is also the telephone number of an Islington flat where Arthur once went to a very good party and met a very nice girl whom he totally failed to get off with. She went off with a gatecrasher. Though the planet Earth, the Islington flat, and the telephone have all now been demolished, it is comforting to reflect that they are all in some small way commemorated by the fact that 29 seconds later, Ford and Arthur were rescued.
End of Disc 2.